Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
I recently played a parlor game where I was asked to name a song that describes my current work atmosphere. For me, one song that captures healthcare at this moment, regardless of your role in it, whether a doctor, nurse, patient, or other, it would be this. The iconic Queen David Bowie collaboration, simply named Under Pressure. This classic song with its recognizable beat and rhythm captures the intensity and the feeling of being overwhelmed, which can be relatable for all of us in the healthcare system. It's also a perfect metaphor for the challenges faced by individuals with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. The lyrics touch on themes of pressure and stress, which are very relevant to the experiences of managing ADHD. Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare science at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, we're talking about ADHD. Now, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a diagnosis known as a neurodevelopmental condition that most often occurs in children, but can also be diagnosed in adults. During the years 2020 to 2022, 11.3% of children aged 5 to 17 years had been diagnosed with the condition, according to the CDC. Symptoms include having difficulty concentrating or focusing, difficulty staying organized, being forgetful about completing tasks, and having difficulty sitting still. ADHD is in health news with rising number of cases and drug shortages. Yet, what do we really know about this condition? Our next guest is going to help us out. Joining us from New York City is Dr. Leonard Adler. He is professor, Department of Psychiatry at the New York University Grossman School of Medicine, and he is director of the Adult ADHD Program. Dr. Adler, welcome to our program.
Joe, happy to be here today.
We are delighted to have you. Let me start with a question I get very frequently. We know that ADHD is diagnosed in both adults and kids, although oftentimes we think kids more than the adults. But that brings up the question, does it look the same in adults and kids? How does it differ?
So actually, it does differ in terms of presentation. Adults are not just grown-up children. As children go from childhood to adolescent to adulthood, if they have ADHD, the hyperactivity tends to go into the background. It's more often felt rather than manifested. And the inattentive symptoms tend to come more forward, meaning that the trouble paying attention, easy distraction, forgetfulness is about twice as common in adults as the hyperactive impulsive symptoms. In children, the hyperactive impulsive symptoms are more common.
That's interesting. I'm curious, as we start this out, would you want to put out for us, for our listeners, for me, what are the biggest misconceptions about ADHD that you would want to hope we dispel here and now?
So there are a number of misconceptions. One is that everybody has a little ADHD. ADHD is a real impairing disorder. It affects over 4% of the U.S. adult population. We did a community-based study with Ron Kessler at the Harvard School of Public Health. We actually went in and interviewed people in the community who had not been diagnosed before and did structured interviews and found that over 4% of them actually had ADHD. And I think that number has been verified by World Health Organization studies, a little higher, a little lower, depending east, west, developed, undeveloped. But that number holds true between like 2.5 and 5.1% throughout the world. So it's a very common disorder and highly impairing. There are four cardinal areas that you have to meet to make the diagnosis. And those are sufficient current symptoms. That means 5 out of 9 significant symptoms of inattention and or hyperactivity, impulsivity. Mm-hmm. Then the second symptom set is that you have to have significant symptom onset in childhood. The roots of the disorder have to go back to childhood. You don't have to be diagnosed in childhood, but you have to have some significant symptoms in more than one setting in childhood. Third thing is there has to be impairment. And this is what makes it different from just some having trouble people. People may have, they don't sleep well, but it's the pervasiveness of the symptoms more or less throughout their lives and the real impairment from the condition. And we can talk about the consequences of the impairment that adults with ADHD who are not treated have. And lastly, you have to be sure it's ADHD and not another mental health disorder, because over 50% of the time, a mood disorder like depression or bipolar disorder or substance use disorder or a learning disability can occur when there's ADHD in an adult.
Let me kind of follow up on that because one of the things we've seen is that there's this huge rise in the number of cases, and telemedicine is out there. How is diagnosis made for this condition?
So there are no shortcuts in making this diagnosis. You have to walk through and those four different areas that I discussed: significant symptoms now, symptom onset in childhood, which means taking a developmental history, looking for impairments, and then really taking a full psychiatric history to see if the symptoms, and longitudinally meaning, if the symptoms are from ADHD and not something else. I've developed screeners that help identify people at risk for ADHD, but no set of 6 symptoms can tell you if somebody has ADHD or not. They can only tell you if they're more likely to have it and need further evaluation. So there are no shortcuts here. Why the numbers are going up? I think that's really multifactorial. Certainly telemedicine has something to do with it, improved access, but also these evaluations have to be done correctly. And that's how I've spent my career, is training clinicians how to do this and do this correctly. Because we want the diagnosis to be made correctly so that we get the right medicine and the right people, because the consequences of missing an ADHD diagnosis are significant.
So let me get that right, to kind of get it super clarified. For on the evaluation side, if someone is being looked at for the possibility of this diagnosis, it's a very specific clinical, you have to have these symptoms, and they have to see someone who's trained to look for this. Is that the bottom line?
Well, the clinician should have some experience in evaluating individuals with ADHD. We've spent time developing quality measures, trying to understand how the monitoring for adults with ADHD, how the diagnosis can be made and how that's implemented for primary care clinicians, and for non-psychiatrists and psychiatrists. But I will say that we've done numerous surveys over the course of the years, and for many years, primary care physicians were very uncomfortable making the diagnosis of ADHD, feeling they didn't get adequate training. Only in the last couple of years have we started to see a little bit more comfort in their training. So I think we are moving the needle a little bit. The other important thing to note is that the American Professional Society of ADHD and Related Disorders is in the process of developing adult ADHD diagnosis and treatment guidelines. Those should be out by the end of the year. And of note, there are no U.S. guidelines for adults.
Wow.
There are guidelines from Canada for adults. There are UK guidelines. There are multiple European guidelines. There are guidelines from Australia. But this will be the first set of adult guidelines, which will hopefully provide guardrails for clinicians and guideposts for how they go about and do this.
So one of the things that also comes up as a big question is there are a lot of people that want to immediately go and blame social media and all the stuff going around in our lives that, you know, make it so frenetic, if you will. So my question to you, is this about environment or is this about genetics?
So we know that ADHD tends to run in families. If there is a child in the family with ADHD, there's a 50% chance that one of the two parents will have ADHD. So it's a highly familial disorder, and there are over 10 candidate genes that we know are involved. So there's not just one gene. We're not down at the point of being able to make a diagnosis based on genetics. But these symptoms and impairments don't occur in a vacuum. The busier life is, the more distracting life is, the more it may bring the symptoms forward. That being said, the internet has many blessings to it also. The question is how the individual uses the internet. If they're sitting there and have a job to do while they're working on, at their desktop and are productively using the internet to do their job, that's using the internet and an effective coping strategy to effectively help manage their ADHD. If on the other hand, they have 10 windows open, looking for their next job, where they may be traveling for their next vacation or shopping, or checking out the newest song, and they're distracted by all the windows they have open on their computer, well, those aren't particularly effective coping strategies from the internet.
Understood. One other question about who gets affected. Is this more gender specific? Are men and women, boys and girls equally, or does it skew to one sex versus another?
So we know that in childhood, the diagnosis is more common, 2-to-1, 4-to-1, boys to girls.
Wow.
But as we go into adulthood, the gender split is almost even. And that means that as we go into adulthood, more women relatively are coming in for their first diagnosis. And that's in part due to women carrying a higher loading of the inattentive symptoms, as I mentioned earlier. Because adults have a higher loading of these inattentive symptoms and women have more of them, they're more likely to come in and be identified in adulthood. And because they have a lower loading of the hyperactive impulsive symptoms in childhood, they're less likely to be behaviorally disruptive. Now, we've done a better job identifying children with inattentive symptoms recently, but if you think about it, in a classroom setting, if you're interrupting the teacher, talking out of turn, getting in and out of your seat, you're more likely to be identified as having something going on than if you're missing something, if you're not paying attention, which is more likely to be missed.
So that brings me to the question, if you don't get diagnosed, what are the long-term effects of untreated ADHD? What can happen?
One effect is that we know that if you don't get diagnosed and you carry a higher symptom burden, the chance of the disorder persisting into adulthood is greater. That's one thing. But one thing that affects persistence as you go from adolescence into adulthood is symptom loading. So the higher level of symptoms and impairment, the greater the chance that your condition will persist because it remits 50 to 60% of the time. So that's one thing. But if, let's say you're above the age of 26 and you have been diagnosed with the disorder and it's not treated, you're at higher risk for divorce, separation, motor vehicle accidents. You're more likely to smoke cigarettes. You're less likely to quit. because of high risk-taking behavior, more likely to contract the sexually transmitted disease. The consequences of not getting the diagnosis and not getting the condition treated are significant, especially because we have good treatments available.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about ADHD, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. Dr. Adler, one of the hallmarks of treatment, and boy, this has been in headlines left and right because of shortages, is the use of stimulant medications. But I'd like to ask, it seems like if you use stimulants when you're talking about this inattention, it almost seems like we're going the wrong direction. Can you explain why do we use these medications to manage ADHD? And is there anything before medications in terms of management?
So many adults with ADHD receive medication treatment in part because they've been living with their symptoms all of their lives, and the symptoms are more ingrained. That doesn't mean that our psychotherapies like cognitive behavioral therapy can't be highly effective, and they often are. But just because of the ingrained nature of the symptoms and impairments, medications are more commonly used first in adults as compared, let's say, to children. But cognitive behavioral therapy can be especially helpful, especially when we're looking at treating some of the associated symptoms that travel with ADHD, like executive function deficits, which are higher level problems with organization, planning, task execution, keeping things in mind. Those things tend to be a little, even though they're not part of the core ADHD symptomatology, they travel with ADHD, and they're less medication responsive and respond better to cognitive behavioral therapy. But that being said, if medicines are going to be used, there are two classes of medicines: the stimulant medicines, which you referred to, and then the non-stimulant medications. Both are useful in ADHD for children and adults, and not every adult with ADHD who's taking a medication has to take a stimulant medicine. The non-stimulants are effective too. Both classes are FDA approved. Now, I think you referenced the fact that it seems somewhat paradoxical that we have individuals who are somewhat hyperactive and maybe using medicines that are called stimulants. They're called stimulants because they increase release of two chemicals in the brain that we know are active and that are, in terms of their relative levels, need to come up in terms of ADHD treatment. And those are norepinephrine and dopamine. So they're called stimulants, not because we're stimulating individuals who are already stimulated and having a paradoxical effect. They're called stimulants because of the way they act pharmacologically.
Understood. Because of the headlines about a lot of shortages of medications for this condition, I'm just curious, what do you suggest? Because I imagine that's what our listeners will be asking us. What do you suggest people should do when there is a shortage of whatever med has been prescribed for them out of those classes?
So the medication shortage has been ongoing for a while now, and the reasons for it are multifactorial. We talked about that diagnosis has gone up recently in part due to the pandemic. More people came in for diagnosis as in general for mental health disorders, but in true for ADHD, telemedicine. And then there were supply shortages that occurred in part due to the breakdown in the supply chain during the pandemic, but also there were specific breakdowns in the production for some of the ADHD medications. So it's multifactorial, both demand and supply, and it created shortages. And then also on top of that, I like to use an analogy, like if you're driving along and you are using, a driving program that's going to tell you how to go, and everyone else is using the same driving program. Well, if there's an accident up ahead and if everyone gets diverted on the same route, there's going to be a delay on the route you're diverted to. So what happens when there's a shortage of one medicine and everyone gets diverted onto the next medicine, that medicine comes in shortage too.
I see.
So it's an ongoing kind of revolving problem. So we've seen shortages of both the methylphenidates and the amphetamines, both classes of our stimulants. And how is this attacked? Well, the first thing that I tell my patients is that, you know, my responsibility is to write the prescription as often as we need to try to get this filled. That I can't tell if a pharmacy has a medication. They don't tell me any more than they will tell the patient. But I will write it, rewrite it as often as we need to. In New York State, we fill it electronically. So I have to send it in electronically. If they don't have it, we cancel it and send it to a new pharmacy. But we do try to keep track of which ones are in shortage. And sometimes if they're really just not available and we have to consider switching, which is can be difficult for patients, but sometimes has some benefits, and that I've had patients switch medicines and do better on a new type of medicine that they may not have tried.
One of the things I want to make sure I ask you in our limited time is, what do you hope folks listening to our conversation today will take away from, should take away from our conversation that maybe they didn't know about, that you'd like to make sure that they walk away knowing a little bit more about ADHD that perhaps they didn't before?
So I'd like them to be aware of the concept that ADHD is a real condition. And if they're worried and hearing about the condition and the symptoms and the impairments we've talked about, to go to their clinician and get evaluated. There are good screening tests available, questionnaires. There's a 6-item screener. It's available on the NYU website, readily downloadable. And they can take it, or their clinician can take it, to identify individuals at risk, because the consequences of missing this diagnosis are significant. You want to be sure the evaluation is done and done correctly. But if you're worried about it, go get evaluated.
Great advice. I have one listener question that came to us on the topic, and this is from a med student in Miami, Luis, and he asks the question, and I think you've alluded to this, but I'll ask it anyway. Can you diagnose ADHD by telemedicine? What role can you do it that way virtually, as opposed to you must be in person?
So telemedicine offers certain advantages and certain disadvantages. You don't have the face-to-face contact with the individual, but certainly the pandemic showed us that we can make a diagnosis, but it doesn't change the thoroughness of the evaluation that you need to do. You still have to take that developmental longitudinal history looking for ADHD symptoms through the individual's life. Because you're taking developmental history, you often have to get collateral information as to what the individual is like in childhood. It doesn't create a shortcut. There is a bit of a barrier in that you only see what the camera shows you during telemedicine. But there is one advantage. If you're worried about the organizational status of the individual, I will have the patient, you know, turn the camera around and let me see what the room looks like and see if there are piles of papers or things like that. Can't do that if they're in the office.
Dr. Adler, in our last moment here, I want to make sure I get this question in. What advancements do you see coming down the line that could really shake all of this up, whether treatment or diagnosis of ADHD? Is there something that you're looking at?
So we're looking at new and better treatments with novel mechanisms. Those are still coming down the pike. We're looking at novel therapies, newer non-pharmacologic therapies. And I think the adult ADHD guidelines will be a true advance for clinicians, giving them some real guideposts as to how to approach the diagnosis and treatment.
Dr. Adler, I just want to thank you so much for giving us your time on this topic. Your work is so important. We hope we can get you back once those guidelines are out.
Happy to come back.
We've been talking to Dr. Leonard Adler. He is professor of the Department of Psychiatry at the New York University Grossman School of Medicine. and the director of the Adult ADHD program at NYU. And up next, our weekly health headlines. We'll be right back. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only had to run so far, so good. But you will come to a place where the only... Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist and professor of healthcare administration and policy. This is What's Health Got to Do with It? These are your weekly health headlines. Dengue fever, a mosquito-borne viral illness, is spreading rapidly worldwide, with the Americas reporting nearly 10 million cases in the first half of 2024, double the total for 2023. Now, while local transmission in the continental U.S. remains limited, Puerto Rico has declared a public health emergency. Dengue, also known as breakbone fever, causes severe symptoms like joint pain, headaches, and high fever. About 5% of symptomatic cases progress to severe dengue, which can be fatal if untreated. The Aedes aegypti mosquito, responsible for dengue spread, thrives in urban areas, breeding in small water pools. Despite measures like bug spray and water management, dengue's reach is expanding due to climate change and urbanization. Efforts to control dengue include a new WHO-recommended vaccine, Kadenga, and innovative methods like releasing mosquitoes infected with a particular bacteria that renders them infertile. Meanwhile, a recent Supreme Court decision undermines the FDA's regulatory power, posing challenges for drug and device companies. The ruling weakens the Chevron doctrine, which previously provided predictability for the industry by granting the FDA deference in interpreting ambiguous statutes. Now judges have more latitude to second-guess FDA decisions, leading to potential legal challenges and regulatory uncertainty. This shift could impact the FDA's plans to regulate lab-developed tests, which were previously considered low risks. Labs and hospitals have already sued the FDA, challenging its authority to regulate these tests without congressional approval. The FDA's ability to navigate these regulatory waters will be crucial in maintaining its oversight effectiveness. And those are your weekly health headlines. You know, around this time of year, especially between the holidays that start with Memorial Day in late May, all the way through the 4th of July and Labor Day, my thoughts tend to dwell on veterans. Their service has blessed us all in so many ways. It also makes me think of what needs to be done to best help our vets' health, especially in these very complex times. On a previous show this year, we talked to Nick Howland, who leads the Firewatch and the remarkable program in tracking and preventing vet suicides here in Florida and beyond. So during this time of American celebrations, I asked him to come by and give us an update on what's happened to vets' mental health since we last talked to him. He joins us now in studio. Nick, what a pleasure to have you back.
Dr. Servin, thank you so much for having me back. It's a real pleasure to be here. And as always, thanks for highlighting our mission, which is really to end veteran suicide.
It's so huge, especially at this time of year when we are around the 4th of July. It really does get to this whole heart of what can we do for our vets. Can you remind us all, to those listeners who may not have caught our first interview together, can you share with them, with us, the core mission of Firewatch and how it aims to prevent vet suicide?
Yes, we call ourselves Florida's Fight to End Veteran Suicide. The Firewatch was started in 2019 in Northeast Florida to do just that, to end veteran suicide. And the way we do it is by prevention. So back in 2019, a number of veteran advocates in Northeast Florida, Jacksonville, St. Augustine, Orange Park, Emile Island, we kind of were noticing there was a palpable high number of veterans dying by suicide in our region. And at the same time, there was a discussion going on in D.C. within the VA about, we're putting so much money into treatment, what if we shifted that money into prevention? So we're watching that discussion and we're saying, why do we need to wait for the federal government to come up with a solution? Let's come up with a veteran suicide prevention solution here. And when we founded the Firewatch, it was all about how do we get veterans to the resources they need before they slip into crisis to prevent veteran suicide. And our cornerstone program became a program that we talked about last time I was on the show, Dr. Servin, called the Watchstander Program. We're engaging the community. We're training members of the community to recognize the warning signs of veterans in crisis, to know how to ask them if they need help or if they're thinking of hurting themselves, and then know how to get them to the resources they need. And the Watchstander Network we built is working.
I love hearing that. You know, as part of the Firewatch's fight to end vet suicide, you track. Your organization does a lot of tracking. And I remember that from our last conversation, because you have the data here in Northeast Florida and throughout the state. And you recently came out with a brand new report. Can you kind of update what's the data telling us since the last time we chatted several months ago?
Yeah, great question. And that's why I'm so glad to be back on the show, because in May, we got the latest Florida veteran suicide data. It's now our third year of data since our program has been in place. And what we're seeing is it's actually pretty remarkable. The main metric that we, as a group, when we stood up the Firewatch, put in place was, hey, if we really want to show that we can prevent veteran suicide, let's see if we can reduce veteran suicides from the 2019 baseline year by 25% for 3 years in a row. That way we've put in a plan that is actually working consistently to drive veterans to the resources they need, thereby preventing veteran suicide. We did it.
Wow.
We just got the data back that shows for 3 years in a row now, we're 25% below the 2019 baseline in Northeast Florida, where we were founded. Altogether, from 2019 to 2022, we're 27% below. It's a remarkable number. It blew us away. We didn't think it would have that kind of effect. And of course, Dr. Servin, it's not just the Firewatch, because our whole program is dependent on engaging training community members to get veterans to the resources they need. Those resources have to do their job. And we're so lucky in Northeast Florida that we have amazing resources for veterans. The VA performs well. We have the Stephen A. Cohen Military Family Clinic, Operation Uniform, Wounded Warrior Project, Canines for Warriors, Northeast Florida Women Veterans. There's really a host of wonderful resources for veterans for treatment. The question became, how do we get veterans to those resources? And our program, as I said earlier, based on the data, is working.
That is, first of all, that's fantastic. That's amazing to hear a huge number now. I hear in terms of how you work with other partners to help you achieve this, can you give our listeners a glimpse on how does it work? How do you involve the community, local businesses, to get to success like that?
Yeah, great question. And when we launched the Watchstander program, and we talked about this last time on the show, in parallel, we tried to solve a data conundrum, because the only data that's ever come out about veteran suicides has been from the VA. And it gives a national picture and it gives a snapshot of each state. But when we were a bunch of folks in Northeast Florida trying to understand what's happening in our region, that palpable high number of veteran suicides in 2019, we wanted to see what's happening in our counties and our regions. Well, we brought on a partner called NLP Logics, and they got that data for us from the Department of Health, the Florida Department of Health.
Okay.
So we're able, your question is, how does this program work?
Right.
We're able to use the data that we get, because the Department of Health data, which is really at its base our death certificates where veteran is checked and suicide is checked, gives us data by county and within county by zip code, and we can sort by age, race, gender, and means. So what that means is, in parallel to our Watchstander program, where we're trying to train community members to recognize the signs, we can use the data to plan where we train our community members.
Wow.
So if we know, for example, in 2021, there was a slight tick in rise in African-American veteran suicides in Northeast Florida. So we can direct our training at neighborhoods within Northeast Florida, at churches or other community organizations with a high degree of African-Americans there, to teach the community to recognize the warning signs of veterans in crisis and get them to the help they need. We can do that if there's a preponderance of women suicides. We can do it in a specific geography. So our watchstander program, along with our data, work in parallel to make sure that the watchstanders, a 30 to 40 minute training that's free, that's online, or we can train you in person to recognize those signs, we can make sure we're training the right people. That's how it works. If we're training the right people, those community interventions are happening out there and veterans are getting to the help they need.
So other groups like local businesses and things that sort of, they can join in
Indeed.
On this?
Yeah. In fact, that's kind of a funny story. I wish I had planned from the beginning to train organizations and churches. It actually took the PGA Tour to kind of whack me upside the head and say, hey, can you train as watchstanders our entire team or as many as you can? We'd love to have you guys at a lunch and learn to come and train everybody. And I thought, well, let's start developing an organizational aspect where if we train a business or a church or an association on their employees to become watchstanders, they can earn a designation. And so PGA Tour became one of the first veteran safe places. And that just means that you've trained 50% of your employees or 50, whichever is lesser. But I wish I had thought about that program myself. They thought about it, which is amazing because training, it actually helps us when we have the data to show where we either have a geography or a demographic of high veteran suicides. We can use that Veteran Safe Place program to go to a church and say, hey, in your zip code, we have a lot of veteran suicides. It's a high-risk zip code. Let's train your parishioners, or let's train your staff or your clergy. And we can do the same for businesses and associations. And it's become the Veteran Safe Place program, a means of training watchstanders, has become one of our best methods to grow our watchstander network and increase that social network, safety network for veterans in the community.
I love hearing that. Now, as we look to the future, I remember we talked about this a little bit the last time. We're looking at other places in the state of Florida. So before we get to that part, I mean, even with this nice success, how does Northeast Florida stack up against other Florida cities and counties? Where are we?
Yeah, that's another great question, because 27% decrease from 2019 to 2022 in Northeast Florida on veteran suicides in and of itself might not mean much until you compare it to other regions. Well, all Florida veteran suicides during that same period only went down 1%. So in Northeast Florida went down 27%.
Wow.
If you look at civilian suicides, unfortunately, in Northeast Florida during that period, they went up 9%. And civilian suicides statewide are flat. But to your question about expanding to other parts, when our watchstander program hit about 1,000 people in Northeast Florida, because that's where we started, the Florida Department of Veteran Affairs out of Tallahassee came to us and said, can you expand outside of Northeast Florida to the rest of the state? And together we looked at the data and we saw that the Tampa Bay region and the Southeast Florida regions were the highest risk for veteran suicides.
Wow.
So with state funding and other support, we've hired in each of those areas and we're building the networks there. We have almost 1,000 watchstanders probably roughly in each region of that state. So it's rapidly building up and we're already seeing the results. So for those two regions, we consider 2021 our baseline year because we got a two-year delay there. And where we are generally, Northeast Florida, Tampa, Southeast Florida, we're seeing a 16% drop in veteran suicides. Where we're not statewide, there's about an 8 or 9% increase. So our network is working. And if that network was not there, if we didn't have watchstanders in those areas getting veterans to help, I think writ large across the state, we would have seen a more significant increase in veteran suicides over that period.
And to all of our listeners, I want to remind you that you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and we're talking to Nick Howland, Executive Director of the Firewatch, as we hear about the successes of their program in reducing vet suicide in Florida. Nick, one of the things I love hearing all these successes. I mean, it's great when we can highlight good news like this. What challenges are you still, what are the biggest challenges in going across the whole state or talk a little bit about that part of it?
Well, we are winning the fight, but the fight is far from over. If you actually look at some of the data, even here in Northeast Florida, where we're having that great success I was telling you about, from the year 2021 to the year 2022, we have seen a concerning rise in veteran suicides, particularly in Duval County, among older veterans. That's in the Jacksonville area. And what worries us about that is there might be broader economic factors that are affecting these folks, because it's a pretty significant aberration. And so we're engaging with United Way of Northeast Florida and UNF to see how we can address the issue. In some of my preliminary talks, particularly with United Way of Northeast Florida, we think it may be due to the financial crisis or inflation and the housing crisis. So if you think about older veterans, oftentimes they might be on pensions or fixed income. And now we're seeing a pretty extraordinary rise in prices and in housing prices. That could be causing some of it. So we're looking into some of the things, but that also helps us figure out how we address the issue moving forward. So we can actually isolate within Duval County the zip codes that are at highest risk. And we know when we look at age group that over 55, particularly over 75, are at higher risk. So we can go to community groups, retirement villages, and train community members in those places to recognize the signs and help kind of reverse that trend.
I want to kind of ask on that question. So the bigger risk factor, because this actually has come up. I mean, we just did a show recently about literally financial wellness, because it seems to come up more frequently than not. Is it financial? Is it mental health to financial? I know what can you talk about? Is that the big risk factor these days?
I think it's all of the above. I think the risk factors are all of the above. When people ask me, and I only have a little bit of time to summarize it, I say that the risk factors of suicide in veterans are the same as the risk factors of suicide in civilians. They may just be exacerbated. And what I mean by that is, like, if you think about a sense of loss, you're losing your sense of mission, a loss related to a financial loss. It basically, it all comes down to the word loss in my mind. Loss of camaraderie. A lot of those things are exacerbated in veterans. So if you're 18, you're enlisting, you're doing your first four-year enlistment, your next one, you went right from family to the military, where you're with your shipmates or your teammates or kind of battle buddies.
Sure.
And as soon as you're out, you're not with them anymore. So there's a loss of camaraderie. There might be a loss in sense of mission. There might be a financial distress associated with not getting your paycheck distributed to you all the time. Kind of a sense of purpose. I think a lot of those things are factors. But even loss when you're older, and it could be loss of family members or spouse or medical conditions or financial loss or what have you. I think that is the little thing that we're seeing driving the over 55 and the over 75 in particular.
Can you give us a sense of, we talk a lot on the show about mental health care access. And,
yes.
And I mean, it's no surprise. It's not easy. Maybe vets may have some more resources in a rare moment, but can you talk a little bit about mental health care access and how it plays with your strategy for the organization?
Yeah, and of course, one key risk factor is undiagnosed or even diagnosed mental health illness. And that's a huge part of veteran risk factors compared to civilian risk factors. So much so that really a lot of the money that the VA has been investing in to try to address veteran suicide has been in mental health treatment. It works for those who take advantage of it.
Sure.
Every veteran, regardless of discharge, now can seek mental health services from the VA. There's even an act called the PACT Act, which any veteran can walk to an urgent care clinic who is suicidal or an ER, and they'll eventually get treatment, resolution, stabilization, and the bill will go to the VA. It's they're still working a lot of the back end complications of it, but that was an act which they're working to perfect. So that means that no veteran should ever not be able to quickly access treatment for mental health conditions if possible. So the VA is working to increase treatment as much as you can. It's still incumbent upon my organization and organizations like ours to make sure veterans get to those services. One thing, Dr. Servin, you hear probably pretty frequently, and it's probably real important among veterans, is they want confidentiality. So if you think about active duty service members, and we know active duty suicide is a significant issue too, like veteran suicide. A lot of folks who might know they're experiencing mental health conditions will not report it because they're afraid of it affecting their careers. They're afraid of their commanding officers knowing about it. So they seek confidentiality. Veterans often in the same way. They're just afraid of what their employers might feel. They're maybe afraid of what their family members or spouses might feel. They don't want to feel like they let someone down if they have mental health issues, which we all know we'd rather, feel that you're getting treated than that. But there's a wonderful service that's been popping up, not only just here in Jacksonville, but also in Tampa. There's one planned for Southeast Florida and about 16 or 17 other places of the country called the Stephen A. Cohen Military Family Clinic.
Okay, yeah.
And that is free or low cost, totally confidential mental health treatment for active duty service members, veterans, and their families. And it actually ends up, at least in Northeast Florida, being one of the most highly referred services that watchstanders send veterans to. Because veterans say, yes, I know I'd like to talk to somebody, but I'm afraid of confidentiality. Well, call the Stephen A. Cohen Military Family Clinic at Centerstone in Jacksonville. And we're seeing watchstanders do that pretty frequently. And we understand that really all those clinics around the country, built for the same purpose, doing the same work, are bursting at the seams. They're treating veterans and active duty members in high volume.
Yeah, which I can only imagine. Are there some misconceptions that you continue to hear about veteran suicide? And do you want to debunk any of them right now?
Clearly the biggest myth that you hear, and it's probably cultural, it's how we all grew up, that is that if someone is talking about suicide, they're more likely to attempt suicide. And that's so not true. That myth has been debunked by evidence and data and what have you. It behooves someone who's thinking about suicide to talk about suicide, to talk about their feelings, so other people can be there to protect them and be there to get them to help. So that is the biggest myth that in our training, the watchstander training is 30 to 45 minutes. It's free. It's online. Or we can train you in person, all at thefirewatch.org. One of the things that we talk about is that is a myth. Don't be afraid to ask a veteran if they're thinking of hurting himself or herself. Because if they are, they'll probably tell you, and then you know that you need to get emergency crisis help right away. That, I think, is the biggest myth to be debunked.
What kind of feedback are you getting from vets and their families themselves? What do they say to you?
We just got an email yesterday. Sometimes it makes it all worthwhile. If you have a tough administrative day and you get an email like this, it makes it all worthwhile. We heard from someone who heard another podcast that I did in Oklahoma who lost a brother who was a veteran and said, I just took your training and I wish I had known about this. I'm going to share it with everybody I know because it's simple. And it gives you actionable steps to take beyond just asking or thanking a veteran for their service. That's the joy of our program is it's only 30 or 40 minutes. So we're not making people mental health clinicians.
Right.
We're basically, just like CPR, training someone to just be able to recognize the warning signs and call for help really, really quick. And if you have a whole community of people with that training, with that knowledge, who are willing to step in when someone is showing those signs and help them get to resources, then we believe we can prevent or maybe even end veteran suicide.
Nick, in our final moments here, it is around the time of the 4th of July celebrations. Any message you want to leave for our vets and others about the organization or any message you'd like at this time?
Yeah, maybe I could tell a real quick story. We only have a handful of employees. There's five employees and then we've got five major partners, and that helps us deliver our program throughout the state of Florida. And hopefully we can expand into other high risk areas like Texas in the future. But one of my employees is a Marine. He did 8 years with the Marines, and he tells a story that he always starts with this. He says, military people and veterans will never ask for help, but if they're offered help, they'll take it. And he tells a story about how he was at Camp Lejeune, and his company was supposed to assemble for some activity, and his squad of six Marines didn't have a vehicle. So they were in the heat of the summer. They were humping to that spot and, you know, walking through the dusty streets to get there. A personnel vehicle drove by, and in the back were two other squads with plenty of room. And they all just kind of watched that vehicle drive by, and about 100 yards up beyond them, it stopped, it backed up, and it came to them. And someone in the back of the vehicle yelled, "Hey, Marines, you want to jump aboard?" And they all looked at their squad leader, and their squad leader looked at them and said, "Of course, jump aboard. We're Marines. We never ask for help, but if we're offered help, we take it." And then they hopped on board the truck. And that is the premise of our Watchstander program. We veterans don't ask for help, but if we train enough community members to be able to recognize the signs and offer a veteran help, we think we can get veterans to the help they need and help prevent veteran suicide.
Nick, I love that story. A happy 4th of July. And thanks so much for coming in today and talking to us about this amazing success.
Thank you again for having us, Dr. Servin. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. We've been talking to Nick Howland. He's executive director of the Firewatch. And as a reminder to our listeners, if anyone is thinking about suicide or knows someone that is, please remember that there is a national hotline that you can dial at 988, and that's accessible 24/7 at all times. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. Next week's program, we continue our special segment on sleep called Night Shift and a look at medical gaslighting with someone with a rare disease. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.